This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's a group of Northwest Indiana residents who've been very successful in getting communities in the region together to participate in an emissions inventory program that's taking place this summer. Let's find out more. The Resilience Cohort is the organization, and we have with us here in Northwest Indiana the Senior Resilience Coordinator, Kathy Sipple, to talk about it. Kathy, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
If you will explain first how the Northwest Indiana Resilience Cohort is put together, and I know it's part of the Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. How did they decide to come up to Northwest Indiana to help get this program underway this summer?
Well, we lobbied awfully hard to be a part of it. It's a program that Indiana University started in 2019. And in that year, that was their first cohort. Both Gary and Michigan City participated. So that kind of woke up some local citizens to know that the program was alive and well, but we were a little late in spreading the news to our communities. So last year during the pandemic, a lot of interested citizens worked together with me in my role as Senior Resilience Coordinator, as you've already mentioned, with Earth Charter Indiana, to find out how we might successfully put together an application to become Indiana's first regional applicant in this program. And it was really through grassroots effort. We started the outreach to NERPC, the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission. We knew that if we were to be successful, we would very likely need a partner organization that had agency over the whole region, and they seemed like a likely candidate. They tasked us with proving that there was interest from local cities and counties. And so this group of citizens that you mentioned, Connie Wachala was one, Alex Bazan, they are both from Highland. They were key supporters throughout, and we had many, many other additional people who helped. They reached out to the communities where they lived and the counties where they lived. And basically, one by one, Lake County was the first, so props to Lake County. They signed a letter of commitment for NERPC and said that if accepted, that they would like to be a part of this cohort. And we got Porter County, LaPorte County, City of LaPorte, Valparaiso, Chesterton, and then eight different communities within Lake County. If I can just give them a quick shout out, I'm awfully proud of them for saying yes. Cedar Lake, East Chicago, Highland, Hobart, Lake Station, Maryville, Munster, and Schererville all threw their hats in the ring and said, yes, we would like to be part of this application.
Now, besides having NERPC as well as some other organizations along to help on this, plus all the communities that have volunteered their time and services for this effort this summer, will you explain what a greenhouse gas inventory is and how important it is to find out what kind of impact it has on our Northwest Indiana environment?
Sure, absolutely. If we want to do climate action, basically, we don't know how much action we need to do or where we need to target that action if we don't know what the baseline levels of greenhouse gases are. So through doing this initial baseline greenhouse gas emissions inventory, we're going to know how much energy we consume, where energy comes from, community vehicle types and fuel usage, and a lot more. And then with that knowledge, we're going to develop a plan to reduce the emissions cost-effectively, improve public health, mitigate the effects of climate change, and just become more resilient as a region.
Mm-hmm. Are they part of a bigger picture, at least as far as Indiana is concerned, to get the information together for this program to go through this year and into 2022?
Let me take a stab at answering that. And if it's not what you're driving at, you can ask me a different way. But Indiana University has been doing this for a while as part of their, Environmental Resilience Institute. And they work with an organization out of Denver, Colorado, called ICLE. And through ICLE, we have access to ClearPath software. That's one of the top software programs that is available for local governments to conduct this type of inventory. So each week, we have a weekly meeting with our folks from Indiana University, as well as ICLE, and all the other participants throughout the state. So we're kind of a cohort up here in the region among a larger cohort statewide.
That's what I wanted to find out about. I was interested in this, and when you mentioned about the fact that as part of a statewide group, this is obviously the reason is because it takes all of the organizations within every single county almost, or certainly a group of counties around Indiana, to be able to make a difference, especially when you're talking about such a vast project like trying to inventory greenhouse gases.
Yeah, it all starts, you know, somewhere, and there are certainly communities that are very small, just, you know, 1,000 or so people that have done this on their own. But, you know, we in the region, we felt very strongly that we are a region. It's not just a name. You know, we have a lot of folks that commute into one, you know, county that live in another, and, you know, we operate as a region. And so it was a little complex to get this regional application together, and frankly, we're working through all of the, you know, what that means in our data collection, but we've got strong support, and the rest of the state is really looking at us, and we hope that we will attract other regional inventories. Right now, this is pretty historic, not only within the state of Indiana, but even within the country. To the best of my knowledge, there's been one regional inventory like this done in Denver, another in Southwest Florida, and then another, I believe, in Ohio somewhere. I want to say Columbus. So there haven't been all that many done, but we're really doing something pretty historic, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
I understand that there's a group of interns that are helping you all out during this effort this summer called Climate Fellows. Will you tell us what the Climate Fellows concept's all about? And in general, how many people are all together working on this project?
Sure. I'd love to tell you more about that. Indiana University was able to award us two Climate Fellows through their Indiana Sustainability Development Program. And so we have Alec and Angelica. Angelica is from Portage originally and attends IU in Bloomington, as does Alec. He is from Terre Haute. And then in addition to those, we really had a demand, as you can imagine, to get this many inventories done, that we had to hire four additional inventories, or I would say it was our pleasure to be able to hire four additional interns. And we had some help from the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission, and we were very, very happy about that. We had citizen support for fundraising to make it financially viable to pay these interns a competitive wage with what IU offers. So with that additional funding, we were able to hire Lauren from Highland, Heru from Gary, Caroline from Griffith, who was actually our intern last year as well, and Julianne, who is from Munster. So they all have really amazing majors and varied experience. We've got two of the people who have more data and informatics background, and then the rest of the folks have more, you know, earth sciences and environmental policy background. I think what we're able to offer is an economy of scale, number one, for the cities and counties who are participating, that it's costing them a heck of a lot less than it would if any individual city or county was bearing the burden. And we also ended up with such a diverse group of interns that I think they're able to, you know, supplement one another's skills, and we're probably going to have a better report because of their various diverse backgrounds.
I also understand, too, that there are, besides all of these younger people that are either in college or have followed through on environmental fields of study over time, that there's some real veterans that are from Northwest Indiana in particular that have been very close observers of the environmental issues over time. Some of them, I guess, have even been part of the Earth Day celebrations back since the 70s. Will you tell us about all the residents and other people here in Northwest Indiana that are going to be helping out?
Well, you know, I'd say that there's kind of one level of helping out, which was helping out at the beginning, the grassroots support, which honestly, we would never have made it to this place without them. I've already mentioned Connie and Alex. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Caroline, who was an intern last year and is back again. Lucy Mellon was our Earth Charter Indiana intern last summer who helped get this off the ground. Alyssa Juritz from Crown Point, she built the NWI Region Resilience website and was vital in helping us get this off the ground. Blake Gardner from Munster is a Miami University student who helped out last year. Nancy Moldenauer is from Michigan City, and she's been vitally involved in all kinds of sustainability initiatives. She basically single-handedly got us LaPorte County and the city of LaPorte. She also helped get Michigan City on board in the first year's cohort. I know I'm probably going to forget somebody. We did have a lot of help.
There are a lot of people. There are a lot of people helping out.
Besides them, going into this in more of an official realm, I already mentioned NERPC, but Joe Exel from NERPC is the key staff support that NERPC has appointed. And then Kathy Luther, who heads the Environmental Management and Policy Committee, she leads Joe's work, and she also sits in some of our meetings with us. So we have a lot of people involved and interested in making sure that this is successful. And I also want to say that every city and county also has an appointee who helps us with the data gathering and answer some vital questions for the interns.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned at the start of our conversation about the fact that this is a wide-ranging project, and only in some other states, actually, or Denver is what you mentioned, and maybe in Florida, some other places, has this kind of project been going on. Do you think that because of all of this effort together and the nature of Indiana, the industrial state that we are, and certainly the industrial history, which has caused some of the pollution problems that we have in the past, do you think this is one reason why everybody's watching Indiana to see how well we do on this greenhouse gas inventory?
Well, I hope so. I really do. I think it would be great for us to lead the change. And, you know, taking the measurement isn't really the hardest part, right? Mm-hmm. We're just measuring. So what I really love about Indiana University's program is that they don't stop it with the just measuring. They invite all of the participants from the first-year cohort to return in the second year, which is to help communities develop climate action plans to address what's found in the data. So we really hope that we can gather that momentum, and that would be the bigger, better story that I'd love to, you know, be telling that would be even more historic. But what we're doing now is the vital first part. We can't develop, you know, appropriate action plans without doing this measuring step.
Kathy Sipple is the Senior Resilience Coordinator here in Northwest Indiana for a group of communities all together. In fact, we have 14 municipalities around the state and several of them here in Northwest Indiana participating this time around for the 2021 Resilience Cohort. We're talking about a project that is going to take a look at the more serious issues of greenhouse gas emissions and how we can reduce them. And Kathy, thank you very much for the information, and the best of luck for everybody participating in the cohort this summer.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, as the restrictions lifted over time, we're going to find more opportunities, if we haven't done so yet, to get out and do a little touring in Northwest Indiana and the entire Midwest region, for that matter. That means that organizations like Indiana Dunes Tourism is going to be very busy once again. They've sat aside because of the pandemic, and let's find out what's happening lately. Lorelei Weimer is the executive director of Indiana Dunes Tourism, and she's with us from the office there along the lake. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris, for having us.
What seem to be the things that have affected not only your operation, Indiana Dunes Tourism, but just tourism in general here in the Midwest, certainly because of the pandemic?
Well, it had a huge effect. You know, overnight, worldwide, our industry was really impacted. You know, we're composed of attractions and hotels and restaurants, and certainly when those stay-at-home orders happened, you know, those businesses were greatly impacted. But one of the things that we found that was helpful to us in our area, in Porter County and in Northwest Indiana, is that people needed to do something, you know, and they wanted to do something that would allow them to continue to be safe, but able to get out of the house. And so they were able to come and enjoy the national park and the state park. And we have so many wonderful trails and the beaches and so forth. And so they were able to, they found us. Some people discovered us because of the pandemic, because our parks never closed during this time. And so people were able to come and safely recreate outdoors and be able to enjoy time with nature, which maybe somebody hadn't done for a while.
Did you find that when things closed up in Illinois, and of course we're not closed here in Indiana, that folks made the trip across the state line, and that led to a lot of more attendees to show up at various events, at the ones that were still being held, and just the attractions at the lakefront show?
Yeah, mainly what we saw is almost all of our events across the board were canceled. And so it was mainly just coming to experience the dunes and our hiking trails, not only within the dunes, but outside the dunes at some of our other parks, because it was something that you could do safely. Certainly with Chicago closing, we were not anticipating them closing as long as they did for the season. And so that brought over a lot more people that were coming over. We did have some issues, and I'm not going to say that we didn't have issues. There were definitely some issues, and there were some activities that were not activities that we could tolerate. And so we did have to, in June, we had to get law enforcement involved, because this is a family destination, and it's a great destination. And so we wanted to make sure that people understood that that kind of behavior was not going to be tolerated. So, you know, there was more people than we anticipated at some time, but we had to work through those issues. But, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of people rediscovered state parks all over the state of Indiana, not just in our area. And I think they reconnected with nature, which is a very positive outcome.
You mentioned the state parks in particular. Of course, Indiana Dunes Tourism in the name includes two parks. One of them is, of course, the Indiana Dunes State Park, and the other, of course, is the Indiana Dunes National Park. What was the impact on tourism that you noted, certainly at the outset after the big name change, and how has it been able to carry through even to today?
Yeah, so the National Park saw an increase of 21% in attendance since 2019 because of that name change. And because people confuse the two parks and don't realize they actually have a state park that's surrounded by the national park, they too saw an increase, I think, in revenue by 8% in 2019. So that name change was significant, Chris. But then the pandemic coming on the heels of the name change and people looking for those outdoor opportunities, it increased even more. So the awareness. And so I think what people have realized is that we have this wonderful asset. Some of the issues is that people came and then they went back home right away, and that didn't translate into them going into, you know, eating at our restaurants or going to our hotels. So we still suffered in those areas, but we didn't suffer as great as we could have if we'd have been a big urban area like the Chicago's and the Indianapolis. But both of them have really reconnected people to nature, and recognizing that we're surrounded by urban areas, that to have a national park this close to an urban area is such a positive to introduce people to the wonderful worlds of the national parks and the state parks.
Let's shift to today, and now that we're near the edge, I suppose we could say, of the maybe towards the end of the pandemic, as things improve with the mass vaccination and fewer cases showing up. What are you finding with response from businesses? Have they been able to start to bounce back from the pandemic to be able to be prepared for more people showing up this summer?
Yes. I mean, our people, our restaurants and our attractions, I think they're excited to get back to normal of what that looks like. Certainly, we're seeing some of the issues that they are seeing across the country in terms of being able to hire help. But a lot of our places are ready to get back to normal and be able to safely do that. And I think that's been the message throughout this entire time for us, has been, you know, wanting people to come back, but at the same time, remember to be safe, not only for themselves, but also for the businesses as well. And we've got some new programs that we're launching this year that I think is going to be a really good fit. Chris, still, you know, engaging with that outdoor, safe outdoor recreation and attractions, but also, you know, getting people excited to explore our communities, because it's really important that we get people to spend the night at our hotels, shop at our shops, eat at our restaurants, and go to our other attractions, because it's all of that together that formulates a really good destination. And so we want to make sure our businesses get back to thriving like they were prior to the pandemic.
What kind of programs that you just mentioned that are going to be in place here in Northwest Indiana within Indiana Dunes Tourism to attract people back into the region, and not only that, but back into the restaurants and the hotels and other places that people have visited?
Well, the Diana the Dunes Dare, and that is at West Beach. I think sometimes people forget about this beautiful asset that we have at West Beach, which is right on County Line Road between Porter and Lake County. And it's less than a mile a hike, and it's really about a challenge. And it's also, Chris, about retelling a ghost story about Diana of the Dunes, which is really the life of Alice Mabel Gray, who is from Chicago. And it's a great opportunity to get a wonderful hike in, learn about Diana, learn about the Succession Trail, but also see Chicago across the lake. So that, again, just go to indianadunes.com and learn about the Diana of the Dunes there. The other thing we want to remind people of is that so many of us, Chris, have four-legged furry friends, be it a cat or a dog, and we see a lot of people actually walk their cats in the dunes. But we do have the dogs are welcomed at the Indiana Dunes National and State Park, and we have a lot of places that are very pet-friendly, and there's this new Bark Ranger program through the National Park. And so we want to encourage people to get out and enjoy the trails and the beaches, but you can also do it with your four-legged friend. There are two places that dogs are not allowed, or three, any of the lifeguarded beaches when the beach season is open, and then also Glenwood Dune Trail, because that's a horseback trail. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, they're welcomed, and we want to encourage people to take advantage of the Bark Ranger program. We have a volunteer drop-in program, and Chris, this is a great opportunity for people to help make a difference in our parks, and that is either picking up trash, or every third Saturday of the month from 9 a.m. to noon, you can go to the National Park Volunteer Office, and they're going to have some opportunities for you to get into the dunes and do some projects that from, you know, removing invasive plants, to picking up trash, but being able to help restore habitats. So there are so many things for both visitors as well as residents to do this this year in terms of some things that are new that maybe they didn't know about.
Lorelei, if you will give us the web address again so people can check out. It's a very expansive website, and you're liable to find things in there that surprise you and events that surprise you as well, and you have to make note of, so you can be sure to come up to Northwest Indiana to check them out.
Yeah, it's indianadunes.com, and you said it best, Chris. It's a very comprehensive website. We encourage both visitors and residents. I think sometimes, Chris, as we as residents, we forget what we have in our own backyard, and we want to encourage our residents to do the same things that we're asking visitors to do. And, in fact, we would love our residents to become those ambassadors to their visiting friends and relatives. And before, when your friends and relatives come, instead of thinking immediately, what can I do outside of our area, think about all the great things you can do within your area, which is taking advantage of the dunes, but also supporting your local businesses.
Lorelei Weimers, Executive Director of the Indiana Dunes Tourism. Thanks for being with us today, Lorelei, and the best of luck as we go into the summer season. Hopefully more tourists coming back into the region, too.
Well, thank you, Chris. I always appreciate your giving us an opportunity to share this great story.
The mostly women team Peretta Autosport made history at the Indianapolis 500-mile race on Sunday. The team's owned by a woman with a woman driver and crew members. The Peretta team started in last position after fighting to qualify, and driver Simona DeSilvestro managed to make it up about 10 positions, but she ended the race early because of a brake problem in pit lane. Team owner Beth Peretta says while the results weren't what they hoped, the team was still a success.
Just being able to have made the field and be on the grid is an achievement in and of itself, because this is a team that started working together 4 months ago. So just to be able to get through this race, I think it's going to give our women a lot of confidence. They were able to face adversity and figure it out. I mean, we had...
Peretta says the team plans to be back in Indianapolis next year. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I remember going to Pulaski, seventh grade. We had a speech teacher. She introduced us to Black poets, Black poetry, and all of us kids were shocked, like, what? Black folks wrote poems? We had never heard of it. I was elated. And I went home and I told my mother, I said, Mama, Black folks wrote poems. Look at this. They wrote these poems. Lacey Hughes, to name just one. But there were so many. She didn't know it either, of course. And she bought the very first book of poetry we owned, and that book was a compilation of poems by African Americans and Caribbean folk, and it also included Europeans. And that is a thick volume. It's not in print anymore. I still have it to this day. My mom was just so thrilled. She bought this expensive book. A book for 20 or 30 bucks was a lot for her. I'm always telling you how she worked. She worked. She always worked. But you know, if she's a woman, she's not going to make what the men make. And she's going to make less than all of the other women. But she's got the same responsibilities, maybe more, because she's single. And so that was a great sacrifice for her to buy that book. But she bought that book. And boy, did I get into those poems. I loved them. I was so grateful to know that. Throughout my life, looking at TV, movies, magazines, there was never, ever anything pleasant said about the continent of Africa, nor the brown, black people in it. It was always bad. It was always sad. It was not stuff that would make you feel proud and honored to be a part of that heritage. They never, ever spoke about ancient Egyptians being chocolate people. That was a well-kept secret. I didn't learn that until I was a grown woman. A very mature grown woman. When I went to Egypt, I saw the pictures on the walls, and the people were black and dark and brown. And I was in awe. This is really true. They were a black race. So why is it hidden? Why is it kept secret? Why is it never mentioned? So to learn that during the Harlem Renaissance, we had these phenomenal poets step out and writers. I mean, you just didn't hear about it in any form or fashion. You know, we've been so disconnected to those truths because we didn't control things that would allow us access to that information. And it all has to do with this thing that's called institutional racism. The group that's in control controls information as well. So if you don't have access to that information, you don't know what your potential is. And the potential is always for greatness.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We talk often about the importance of recycling as it fits together with the overall recycling and solid waste disposal issues here in Northwest Indiana. In particular, in the last few months or even longer, of the issues that have come up with various solid waste management districts are trying to deal with the problems of recycling and throwing stuff in that should be trash. Well, that's another case that's come up again. This time it's in LaPorte County, as we found out in not only in Lake, but in Porter counties as well. And with us to talk about the issues of making sure that you recycle the right things and not leave stuff out to end up going into the trash, we have Sasha G. Burns. She's the environmental educator and the public outreach coordinator for the LaPorte County Solid Waste Management District. And Sasha, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'll turn things over to you sort of to kind of give us an idea. First, how did, at least in recent weeks, the issue that has come up before in other counties of contaminated recyclables come about? What were the problems that come to the forefront in LaPorte County these days?
Well, we've had a lot of illegal dumping lately. So, and a lot of the dumping is mostly because we have recycling dumpsters. We have a public recycling dumpster located in Michigan City. And it's there for residents that have either extra recycling that won't fit in their bin, or for even the apartment buildings where they won't let us put a recycling dumpster because there's not enough room. Mm-hmm. So it gives people still access to recycle that may not have an opportunity just at their regular house. So we have that in place, but we have a lot of folks that have been home for the last month or so and doing extra cleaning and all sorts of, you know, extra household things. and we end up with a lot of items that are not recyclable. Household furniture, electronics, all kinds of stuff like that that is placed at that public recycling bin, which is where you can put all the same stuff that we accept for our curbside program. We recycle electronics, but we have separate locations that we accept electronics at. But the furniture is maybe like our biggest issue, because we have to then pay a company to come and clean that up each day, and it keeps happening over and over again.
How many times would you say, we'll say in the least the last couple months, since the pandemic basically kept everybody at home, and it also caused problems, too, for the solid waste disposal companies that normally would pick up stuff like at curbside, and we're talking about big items like furniture and stuff like that. How long have these problems with these things being dumped outside the recycling center been one of these areas?
Oh, I bet at least 10 to 15 times we've had like a lot of stuff that was, you know, not allowed there, where we've had to have it cleaned up. But mostly, a lot of times we have people that go out there, and usually the ones that report it to us are the ones that are going out there and doing the right thing. And sometimes we have residents that clean it up and we don't even ever find out about it. But other times we have where, you know, city council members and other things are where they get a hold of us, or residents even, that are upset because it's their area to use and it's being abused.
Which companies are the ones that are the prominent trash haulers and maybe to some point recyclers at residences around LaPorte County? And then the ones that probably had to kind of put aside their pickups because of the pandemic?
Well, as far as recycling goes in LaPorte County, we do the entire county. We do the house, our curbside recycling program. And we contract through Republic.
Mm-hmm.
So they do all our pickup for us. We don't own our own trucks. And so they do that. But there's another company in that operates in LaPorte County, too. They're out of Niles, Michiana Recycling and Disposal, I think is what they're called. They also do some recycling, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, now, but we handle the blue bins that are strictly just for recycling.
Now, were these companies, in particular, Republic and you say Michiana Recycling, were they companies that when the pandemic was really, really hitting hard, they had to basically tell their customers and the companies that work with them, we can't pick up any more stuff here. We can only do it with the trucks, with the automatic systems that are on the trucks. No picking up big stuff. When did that have to take place, and has it in turn gone back to normal, so to speak?
So it's gone back to normal, but it was probably like mid-April, I think,
mm-hmm.
that everybody seemed to be putting out their announcements that they would no longer take items, like bulk items, as far as trash disposal. So I know Waste Management, we put out, because we will share everybody's different posts on Facebook if we see, you know, one of the different trash haulers that are doing something different, just kind of to help them get the word out too, even though we just do recycling. So, you know, it was probably mid-April that they started doing that, where they wouldn't pick up the bulk items. And it was across the board. All the different garbage haulers were like that. As far as recycling, we had it where we couldn't pick up things outside of the bins. So a lot of times people have extra cardboard boxes and stuff like that that they'll put alongside of their containers. Or they'll have some bagged recyclables that they'll put in, like, the white or clear bags. But we weren't able to pick those up because we were only doing what was actually inside the bins to kind of reduce the level of any kind of germ spreading.
Right.
Now, we had a lot of trouble with people understanding that, too. So it was kind of, you know, the idea that we had people that wanted us that insisted, you know, on thinking that, oh, they just need to wear gloves, but they would have to change gloves at every household where they pick something up, because if they pick something up at one household that was contaminated, it would easily spread to every single other one if they wore the same pair of gloves.
Yeah, so that's a bad situation, to be sure.
Yeah.
Now, since things have kind of returned more or less to normal, if you want to call it that, have you had any more problems at the public recycling drop-off spot in Michigan City? More stuff junked put outside the containers?
Yeah, we always do. So it seems like it's just becoming more and more prevalent anymore. I think people just don't know what to do with their material.
Right.
So,
okay.
Like, if I have an old bed to throw away, you know, I would go and try to figure out where the proper place is to take that. But, you know, a lot of people, I don't know that that's at the, you know, the front of their minds right now, especially with everything that's going on. We always tell people, give us a call. We're more than friendly and helpful to try to help you figure out where your stuff's going to go. If it won't go into recycling, usually we can figure out where it needs to go, whether it's a landfill item or it's something that can be recycled just somewhere else. So, you know, we always like to point people in the right direction. A lot of times we tell people, you know, if it's something that's still usable, donate it to a thrift shop or a secondhand store to where it can get another use out of it before it goes to the landfill and it has to sit there forever, you know, taking up space.
That's great advice, Sasha. Thank you for sharing that with us today. We appreciate it. Now, what is the phone number or the web address that folks can go to if they would like to get hold of you folks at the LaPorte County Solid Waste District?
219-326-0014, and our website is www.solidwastedistrict.com. And we also have a Facebook page that's LaPorte County Recycling.
Sasha G. Burns is the environmental educator and the public outreach coordinator for the LaPorte County Solid Waste Management District. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. In East Chicago, there is a pedestrian bridge over Columbus Drive that's been in use for years. It is now no longer safe, but there are concerns that NDOT will not replace it. Youngsters have used that overpass to get into the Sunnyside neighborhood and to the elementary school nearby. Off my coast, Michael Puente talked with Stacy Winfield, who wants to see the idea of an overpass over a busy city street kept alive.
Stacy, before we get into the issue, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get involved with this?
Well, actually, Mike, I am a East Chicago resident for 57 years. Actually grew up on Guthrie, but then moved to Sunnyside area. Being in Sunnyside, knew basically it's a small community where everyone knows everyone. Everyone knows everyone's children. And where I came across it, I was one of the first elected school board members that was elected to East Chicago. And it came across me when I was on there, maybe my second or third year, that there was conversation about demolishing the viaduct. One thing about me, I used to work in the school city and for 13 years, so I always had a concern for the children because I was once their age. So when it came across me, I was kind of upset because before the viaduct, there was a tunnel in the 70s. I was one of those students that used to walk under that tunnel. So there was always a pathway to get across Columbus Drive, which you know is a very busy intersection. So when I heard that, I contacted NDOT myself, and I spoke with a young man. I kept in touch with someone, and told him that I was against that demolition of that viaduct. What can we do to save the viaduct, the cross path for the children of East Chicago? I brought it back to the school board members and the superintendent at that time, and we spoke about how can we save it. Well, at that time, NDOT told me that they would actually, there were some repairs. The bridge was old, and there need to be repairs done. At that time, I asked that you please not, it was, might have been around April, we asked that they would not do anything, any repairs until, if possible, until school was out in June, which they agreed, and they did wait till June, but they boarded the viaduct up. At that time, they voted it up until October. And that's when the crossing guards came in action, crossing the children across Columbus Drive because of the board up and the damage that they said at that time that was there. In the meantime, I'm thinking that repairs have been made, so we're good. And then all of a sudden, so many years later, I'm hearing here that once again, demolition is in action. I received a call maybe a week before they had the first meeting.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. According to the Indiana Department of Transportation, work is set to begin on the overpass. It's the intersection of US 12 and Alder Street in East Chicago, beginning on Tuesday, which is June 1st, to demolish the pedestrian bridge overpass. So in addition to that, they say traffic is going to be reduced to one lane in each direction through this intersection, and Alder Street will be closed to the north and south of the intersection. The detour for Alder Street will follow Main Street to the north of George Circle to the south. And I'm looking at this map, and if people can just bear with me. So I guess you go down Alder Street, and then they're going to come all the way around where Franklin School is at. It looks like a mess. And not only that, that's a heavily traveled road on Columbus Drive. So you're going to have all that traffic, possible trucks. So I understand they got to do work, but it does seem like, wow, that's really going to be just with that alone. And it's the work is going to go through July. So it's not going to cross into the school time. But then there's not going to be an overpass when kids have to go and be going back to school. So have you any information as to why they're not going to rebuild this pedestrian overpass?
Well, my understanding through them is that NDOT does not build bridges, Vidox. That's something they do not. And the Vidox was not built through NDOT. They really did not know who built it, whether they called another name. I really don't want to call the name, but there was another company they said that may have done it. But because they did not build it, and that's not what they do. They do not just build.
They don't build them, but they knock them down.
Yes, they do demolish them. I did go around and take pictures of the viaduct myself and where it's fenced off and everything. So there is a lot of damage to the viaduct, but my concern has always been the children. What about the children? What about our children of East Chicago? We were once them. And there's a singer, Yolanda Adams, that says that we were once them. You know, we went through what they're going through. A lot of people say, well, you know, I don't see that many children walking over the viaduct. If 5 children walk across that viaduct, it saves 5 children's lives. So what they said, they had been meeting with the city for 5 years concerning this issue. Me, as the precinct committee person that's been here over 16 years as that committee person, the only time I've heard of it is when it came in front of the school board. Anything else after that, 5 years ago, I have not heard anything concerning it. My concern is the Sunnyside community. We are right there at BMO Harris Bank. That our community exists there. Columbus Drive, there's a street Butternut to where that one lane is going to detour people into Sunnyside. Do the residents know? No, they do not. Is it a concern? Yes, it is, because we have children that actually play out in our neighborhoods every day and on that street. So it's going to be a big mess. They were having conversations with the city and the city officials trying to see what would happen. Can I speak on behalf of the city? No, I cannot. Was it presented to this council that's in right now? No, it has not been presented to us. So I can't speak on behalf of the city. I cannot speak on behalf of the council. I speak on behalf of myself because I once went through this with them, and I'm concerned. And we have a page on Facebook that I let the residents know what is going on, and I continue to do that. But what can we do? We need help. State Representative Earl Harris was there, and that's what he's seeking. He said, what can we do to get help? As far as we were concerned, he told us that their budget year is actually, they did their 2-year budget year. So now how can they help rebuild that bridge if they can, if their budget is already put in for the next 2 years? So when people ask me, so what do you think? I said, do I have faith in another bridge going up? Honestly, no, I do not. Do I want to see another bridge go up? Yes, and I pray every day that we do get something. I hope that whoever is going to come together, because I can't give you a definite answer who's going to be a part of putting this viaduct up or this walkway up for our children, but I just pray that it actually happens.
Have you heard anything from your elected officials, either city council members or the mayor or other state representatives?
Well, I am on the city council. I'm the 4th district councilwoman. I have spoken to my constituents. They are concerned. All 9 of the constituents are concerned. Like I said, State Representative Earl Harris, he's there with us and he's in support. Senator Lonnie Randolph has been, him and Representative Harris have been in conversation with this to see how we can come together. Will we come together for the sake of our children? Right now, this is very important because just as much as the viaduct will be demolished, there's going to be detours once school, and it's not only just when the children are going to school. You have the main library is right there. We have children that go to the library. The library is a safe haven for East Chicago, where you have parents that work, and their children go to the library for the summer programs. So my concern is these children are going to have to cross Columbus Drive alone without no crossing guards, because now it's summer. You know, you could say they're there from 8 to 12, but who's going to be there the other part of the day? What about Saturday and Sundays? Now you have young children that are out. They just go out, and they're walking across the street to go to the track, to the library, to visit family and friends. I'm just so afraid. And they're going to have fencing for the children when they get ready to cross Columbus Drive. But like we said, it's a one lane, and we have semis that zoom through Columbus Drive, US 12, every day. Who's going to control that? Yeah. They're going to change the timing on the stop on the lights. They said they would make a delay for the lights, but will that still save our children?
Right.
Who will be there to assist those children, not only 5 days a week, I'm talking about 7 days, Sunday through Sunday. Who's going to be there to help our children get across Columbus Drive?
And I know a lot of children do use that with their bikes. They like going up there with their bikes. It's right by the library. It's right by the police station. I don't know. It just seems like a situation that could turn bad pretty quick. And you're right. It's not just a school hour issue. It's, you know, during the summer, kids are crossing there all the time. You're not going to have a crossing guard there 24/7 unless, to make it easier, maybe they build a roundabout there. I'm not sure if that would assist kids. Maybe make cars have to actually slow down a little bit more, but that takes years into the planning. And, you know, before we got on this conversation and were, you know, deciding whether to do an interview or not, you were telling me, though, but you came across information that there were actually used to be an underpass on that street. Yeah. And that's before my time. Do you remember that?
I used to walk under the tunnel back in the 70s. It was Franklin Elementary at that time.
That's right.
And we had to, and that was our safe way of crossing Columbus Drive. Trying to go across, we were afraid at that time. The principals had it terror into us. If we catch you crossing Columbus Drive, you're suspended. And the tunnel used to be dark, creepy, and they had lights along the wall. So it was always dark when we went through there, but they had lights on, you know, and they had that. It wasn't the best smelling tunnel, but it was still a safe haven for us to cross Columbus Drive, because back then, in those days, when Emmons still owned Advanced Credit Union, it was very busy like it is now. But our parents were strong, and they stood, and they made sure that there was a way for the children to cross Columbus Drive. So that's why I stand on my grandmother's shoulders, and because she was one that also fought, and to make sure that our children are safe going across. There was someone on social media that actually put a picture of the tunnel. And when I seen that, I was so excited, because I had to tell my children, this is where I used to walk. I walked underground to get across to the library. The library was always there. So this is how we crossed Columbus Drive.
Right, right. Well, you know, hopefully, you never know who's listening to this radio program. Maybe there's like engineers around Northwest Indiana, somebody who can assist. If there are people wanting to get more information, Where can they find it from you?
Well, they could contact me at 219-397-3734. I have a 4th District social media page for the residents that live in this area that also lives across the Columbus Drive and Prairie Park, which will be gravely affected also. So under Stacy Winfield on Facebook, you could also go under East Chicago 4th District community and message me, and I'll return your hit you back. You could call me via Facebook, and we could talk. I hope there's someone out there, different industries, that would say, hey, I will submit and I will help. If the city is going to rebuild, then we could collaborate to for the safety of our children of East Chicago.
Well, Stacy Winfield is a concerned resident of East Chicago. Also sits on the East Chicago City Council. We're talking about the demolition coming up of this pedestrian overpass over Columbus Drive and what's going to be done about it and what's going to replace it. So, Stacy, thank you so much for letting us know and joining us today on Off Mic.
Thank you so much, Mike.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.